Joshua chapter 24. After a long time had passed and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua, by then a very old man, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, "I am very old. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Remember how I have allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain, the nations I conquered between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea in the west. The Lord our God himself will push them out for your sake. He will drive them out before you, and you will take possession of their land as the Lord your God promised you. Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Now, I am about to go the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of all the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled. Not one has failed. But just as all the good things the Lord your God has promised you have come to you, so he will bring on you all the evil things he has threatened, until the Lord your God has destroyed you from this good land he has given you. If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods, and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you." This is the inspired, the inerrant, the God-breathed word from his mouth. Let's open up the Bible, Joshua chapter 23. If you're wanting a text, I suppose, the first verse. After a long time had passed, the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them. Joshua, but then a very old man, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, "I am very old." Whenever an old man says, "I am very old," it can become a very interesting situation because lots of things happen in that case. One is that he's very, very old, so he doesn't really care anymore. There's really no peer pressure at that age. And as Joshua was, he died at 110. So I'm guessing here he was well over 100. You can become very, very honest. Those of you who are young will laugh at me saying, those of us who are very, very young, there's a hubris of youth. There is the need to impress. And that is a mark, I think, of younger people. Whereas, by and large, generally speaking, as one gets old, that same sordid pressure is no longer there. So that's the one reason that the words of old men can be interesting. The second is that they are looking, you're conscious of legacy here, what you want to leave behind. And I know it's an inward just now. Folk are talking a lot about legacy. Folk are talking a lot about succession, what they want to pass on to the next generation. And we're realizing more and more that it's no longer financial things that we're passing on. Indeed, you've got to pay for your old folks' homes, so you probably wouldn't have any financial things to pass on. And so legacy is becoming more and more important in terms of our spiritual inheritance that we're leaving the generations to come. Now, these, I guess, are among the last words of Joshua. Last words are very interesting because last words very often reveal our greatest passions. Gustav Mahler, the composer, I think, his last words were, word was Mozart. I don't know what he was thinking, but that's what he said. Jean-Paul Sartre, of course, his famous relationship with his partner, Simone de Beauvoir, whom he called Beaver. He turned round to her and says, I love you very much, my dear Beaver. That was what was important to him. Mozart for Mahler, Simone to Jean-Paul Sartre. To Joshua, it's God. He's just obsessed with God, with what God has done, with what God is going to do, with what God could do with these people, if only they will have discipline in their lives, if only they will obey the word that God himself has given them. So here we've got the parting words of Joshua. Again, let me remind you, he died at the age of 110. This is the second of three farewell gatherings. We saw the last one last week in chapter 22, where he spoke to the 2.5 tribes. Here we've got Joshua's farewell to the leaders of Israel. And next week, God's willing, we have his renewal at Shechem, when he's saying farewell to the whole of the nation. So what we're doing here is we're looking at Joshua chapter 23, and I think that as we go down the verses, there's many things that we can notice, but you've got to be selective in these things. And I think we notice four things which stand out. The first thing we notice here is passing on the legacy. Passing on the legacy. Excuse the PowerPoint. It was maybe a mistake to do it. There's nothing wrong with your eyesight. It's supposed to be squint. Passing on the legacy. That's the first one. Look at verse 3. I am very old. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. Okay. So Joshua was going to die, but the leaders were slightly younger than him, and they were going to go on. They were going to bring the people of God to the next phase in their history. And you can see in the language there, he's saying, look, I want you to bring the people on there. You have seen everything that the Lord has done. They saw the parting of the Red Sea. They saw the Battle of Jericho. They saw the defeat of all the Canaanite tribes. They saw these amazing things. And Joshua is saying, I want you to remember them and I want you to pass them on to the next generation. Let's just stop there. Let's just stop. Isn't it absolutely unbelievable that this would be needed? That they would have forgotten that? They had experienced victory. They had seen miracle. God had brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey. God had fought for them. And yet it was conceivable that within one or two generations, they would have forgotten absolutely everything that God has done for them. How quick our collective memory can go. How quick our individual memory can go also. We saw it this morning in Luke chapter 17. Jesus healed the 10 lepers. And what an illness that was. And then we find that only 10% come back to say thank you to Jesus. What a thankless crowd. And yet we see it in our own lives. You can see, I'm sure there's no thankless children here, but very often, oh, Mom, oh, Dad, just don't turn up at the school gate, please. Or if you come to collect me, can you park your car on the other street? Or, you know, just don't come to my friend's house, okay? Just don't be seen out in public. And it's how quickly we forget what our parents have done for us. I will not recall in a public place what parents do for children, but they do lots of things which are very, very messy and not very, very comfortable. And yet, often as children, all of us can be thankless towards our parents. And yet, this is what happens. If you look at Judges chapter 2, verse 10, it says this: after that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served their Baals. Now, I'm not sure how that happened. I'm not sure why they went to worship these other gods. Was it intermarriage? Probably. Were they molded by the society? Definitely. But within one or two generations, the whole thing has gone. How can we apply this? Well, I think we apply this in many ways. There's a key word in verse 1. After the Lord, the time had passed and the Lord had given Israel rest. That word rest is the one that I'm underlining and circling in my notes. Because the story of rest is the story of the Bible. The story of rest, shalom, peace, is the whole melodic line of the Bible. From Genesis to Revelation, Jesus died that we might have rest. The inheritance of the people of God is heaven. And that's the eternal rest of the people of God, as Hebrews tells us. And so what we have here is a picture, a precursor of the rest that Jesus procured for us. It really is a wonderful thing. So how can we apply this? Well, it says there, you yourselves have seen everything the Lord God has done. We have been privileged to see that. We've heard the gospel. We've heard that you've got to be born again. We've seen that. We have experienced the new birth. We've been in the middle of the exhilaration of the worship of God. We've experienced God. Heaven has come down. We've known the glory of God. We've been impacted. We've said, surely God is in this place. From time to time, we witness that. How important it is to pass on this legacy. I wonder what the message will be from this podium in 20 years' time, in 50 years' time. I'm sure it'll be the same message as it is today, and the same message that it's been for many years. But I wonder, is there a possibility of a message lacking in sharpness? Is it possible that he or she who proclaims the gospel here will not speak of the great themes like the virgin birth, the resurrection? Will not think of the second coming, heaven, hell, the big themes. King Richard III, well, in his day he was a great man, but you know how King Richard III ended up? He ended up under a car park in Leicester. Now, I'm sure that when he was a boy growing up as Prince Richard, he would not think that one day he would lie under a tarmac in the middle of Leicester. That's a fate worse than most things. Being alive in Leicester is bad enough, but being dead. What about John Knox? Do you know where John Knox is buried? One of, probably, arguably, Scotland's greatest thinker ever. John Knox is buried under car park space number 23 outside St. Giles. There is a little plaque if you look hard, but he's buried under a car park. Unbelievable. How quickly folk are forgotten. How quickly our legacy as a nation is seen as merely something that the Edinburgh City Council can squeeze out an extra few £100 parking fees for, rather than pay homage to the great man. The application is pass on the truth, folks. Let's pass on the legacy. Pass on this thing. That's what the passage is about. Summon all Israel, the elders. He says, you guys, you've experienced, you saw what God has done. Now, if you pass it on, that will not guarantee blessing. But not passing it on will guarantee generational failure. Remember what the theme is. It's rest that God has given them. That's the message of the Bible. Passing on that legacy. That's the theme, for example, of Psalm 78. You all know Psalm 78 well. It speaks there about things that we have heard and known, things our ancestors have told us. We will not hide them from their descendants. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord. I think young folk like to hear about the olden days. It's when, you know, a 10-year-old says to their 40-year-old mum, "What was it like in the old days, mum? You know, in the days when you used to take your pet dinosaur out a walk. What was it like?" They love hearing about the old days. What about not simply a nostalgic retelling of exaggerating tales, but the great days of the gospel, the great themes of the word of God, the passing on the legacy. Francis Schaeffer, in his very interesting book on Joshua, he notes that we're not passing on fairy tales. This is not like the great oceanic myths of Celtic mythology. You see there, if you go over to Skye and MacLeod's Tables there, and the great story of how the giants had their dinner off the tables. Skymen may be big men, but I'm not too sure if any of them dined off a mountain. They're fables, they're stories, the fairy flag. You MacLeods, if you ever get in trouble again, you wave the fairy flag. If you've seen the fairy flag, you're in bigger trouble than you thought you were. It'll fall apart. These are myths. But Joshua is, as Schaeffer says, rooted in space, time, history. These are things you could see. These are things they heard. This is reality. It's not the passing on of a mythology. Let me apply this further. This is the task of the church to pass it on. But it's also the task of the home. How many children in the congregation here at Smithton, their only Bible input is the 40 minutes on a Sunday morning, the Sunday club? It's not enough. It really is not enough. It's not our responsibility. It's our part of the responsibility. It takes a village to raise a child. But it's the responsibility of the home to pass on the legacy. Tell it as it is. And it's a great story. The God who performed miracles. Jesus who became flesh. The one who walked in water. Calmed the storms. The one thousands flocked to him. He was pulled with violence from Gethsemane. He was nailed in a cross there. He atoned for our sin. It's a great story. Pass on the legacy. Isn't that the first thing we see here then? Passing on the legacy. The second thing is giving the credit. Giving the credit. I think what strikes me about this chapter is it is utterly God-obsessed. Every single verse, it seems to me, screams the greatness of God. Verse 1, the Lord had given Israel rest. You see it there in verse 3, everything the Lord your God has done, the Lord your God who fought for you. Verse 4, remember how I allotted the territory. Verse 5, the Lord your God, it's there, it's just absolute everywhere. And in particular, verse 5, we have there, the Lord your God himself will push them out for your sake. It was God who did it. One of the Facebook feeds I subscribe to is the White House, because I'm interested in America. It's one of my interests. And of course, yesterday was the 4th of July in the USA, Rebellion Day, of course, when they decided to go on their own without any of our help, and they emptied their tea chests into Boston Harbor. And July the 4th, President Obama put up a little thing, and he said this, unbelievable. He said, there is nothing that America cannot do. It's a great nation. But America could not grow a blade of grass without God. Britain couldn't do it. No country can do that. And I'm sure we are just as bad as that. You see here, God gets the credit. Was Obama being serious? Now, in revealing the power of God here, Joshua is hinting at what the problem could be. So, we're finding here he's given the credit to God. He's God-obsessed. He says, God has done it. God brought you into the land. God helped you to overcome all the Canaanites. God gave you power. God gave you insight. God was with you. Without him, you could do nothing. The problem was that Joshua, I think, was looking ahead at what the sin was going to be. And the sin was going to be very, very simple. Arguably, it's the root of all sin. It is the belief in personal autonomy. Did God really say? Or, I can do it my way. I don't need God. The sin of the elevation of personal autonomy. I don't know, those of you who read this, a fascinating book written by the former Times journalist. Her name is Rachel Kelly. And the book is called The Black Rainbow. The subtitle is How Words Healed Me. It's on depression. Rachel Kelly suffered from depression. So the book, again, is called The Black Rainbow, How Words Healed Me. Great book. It is how poetry, reading poems, helped her through her depression. And it's really well argued about the benefits of poetry. Especially the poetry, I think, of George Herbert really influenced her and helped her get through all these things. And she speaks about her depression with searing candor. It's very, very honest. Those of you, and there are many of you here who've suffered from depression, I think would enjoy the book. That's by and by, but she writes an interesting thing about growing up as a young woman in the British culture. Okay, it's almost disconnected with depression, but at the same time perhaps connected. She said this. She's by the looks of her early 40s. My generation, she says, has been raised in a culture of self-empowerment. That, with know-how, medicine and technology, problems could be solved. I could solve this problem. Why? I could write articles at high speed and edit features, pages, and all manners to do with housing, homelessness, and architecture, and then come home and rustle up supper. I'd gone back to work after Edward's birth without trouble. I would do it all again. Surely I would, because that's what I do. I can do anything. I'm self-empowered. And then she wrote, when she was depressed and she was unable to get up in the morning, she was unable to move, she was unable to function normally. Many of you know exactly how that feels. She writes this, at first this dependence seemed a horrid passive thing. I was beholden to others, relying on their charity, burdening them. The whole point of my life had hitherto been to become independent. It was the mantra of my generation. Women could and did multitask, both at home and at work. And it's not just career women, it's not just young women who have that mentality. All of us think we can do it. From a hard-working crofter who says he doesn't need any help from his next-door neighbour, to the executive who thinks he can do everything, to the minister who thinks he's God's gift to a congregation, to a housewife who thinks that they're God's gift to their family. We can do anything we want. And our culture is saying that. Now, there's a happy medium from the traditional Scottish culture that we're all rubbish and we're hopeless and we can do nothing. To, we are all supermen and superwomen, and we can do anything. Give the credit to God. Joshua is looking ahead here, and that's a potential problem in the new situation. And he's saying here, Lupin, God is the one who is with you in the past. If God has provided for you in the past, he will provide for you in the future. Not one promise has ever failed him. What had the false gods ever done for him? What did the false gods ever done for him? I don't know, you may use someone, I don't know, you've got a plumbing problem and you've heard of Wee Archie who does a wee bit of plumbing. And you employ Wee Archie and he's absolutely hopeless. You know, he goes away, your roof falls in, it's just an absolute disaster. Apologies to, again, any wee Archies out there who do plumbing. This story has got no relevance to any characters, fictional or real. But you don't go back to him again because he broke his promise. He didn't turn up. He didn't do the job. He is a serial letdowner. The gods of the Canaanites were serial letdowners. What had they done for the people of Israel? Nothing. God had kept his promises. God had kept his promises. And they're told there in verse 6, look, be very strong now. Let's note this. This is fundamental. This is important. It's all important. This is even more important. Be very strong. A Christian being strong is different to a worldly concept of strength. What image do you have of a worldly concept? If you're a guy, it's a muscular arm. If you're a girl, it's maybe just one of those multitasking, amazing people who can do anything. The tough guy who can get you out of the spot. No, that misses the point. Because it says there, verse 6, beginning of the paragraph, be very strong. That is unpacked by verse 8. But you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. We can only be strong in that we hold on to God. We saw it this morning, faith is not in the power of the person who's got faith. You see these pictures, don't you, of the cyclones in, I don't know, Philippines or Hawaii or somewhere, or salt coats. And you see the wind, and it's really, really howling. And the TV reporter with that big furry thing. And what are they doing? They're holding on to a lamppost. Their strength is weak, but they are depending on the strength of that which they are holding on to. You hold on to that which cannot give way. God cannot give way. Maybe that's a simplistic thing to hear in a church, but it's the bedrock of our faith. All may change, but Jesus never. Passing on the legacy, giving the credit. Thirdly, obeying the law. Obeying the law. You see it there, doesn't he? Look at verse 6. Be very strong. Joshua's last words to the leaders is farewell. He's saying pass on the legacy. He says give the credit to God. Verse 6, be strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. This almost sounds strange to contemporary evangelicalism, these words, obey all that is written in the book of the law, because the emphasis now is we're not under the law, we're under grace. The emphasis now is that the commandments don't really matter, and it's a multiple choice situation. We can pick and choose whichever of the commandments. Now, every single one of us break the commandments daily. We know that. I know that. But there's still God's law. There's three uses of the law. Let me remind you of the three uses of the law. The first use of the law is a mirror. It's a mirror in two ways. Number one, it shows us the righteousness of God, and it shows us our own sin and need. So the law is a mirror. And when we look in the mirror, we see two things. We see the perfection of God. It's like you go down to Slater's. It's mostly a gentleman's shop, I think. You go to Slater's, and you look in the mirror, and just behind you, you maybe see a picture of one of those models, one of these athletic figures, and the suit always looks amazing in these people. And you say to the gentleman, I want to look like that guy there, and he looks at you and says, well, I can't do miracles. But you're looking in the mirror and you're seeing this perfect image, and then you're seeing yourself. That's what the law does. God's law is perfect. It shows us that God is holy, God is without failing, and it shows us that we are absolute wretches. It's the first use of the law. The second use of the law is it restrains evil. You know, if there was no speed limits, we'd think that would be marvelous, but it would be anarchy, wouldn't it? you know, 70 mph in Murray Road, it would be desperate. A9, no speed limit at all. We laugh at speed enforcement, but I think road traffic deaths is one of the biggest killer in Scotland. Murders, nothing compared to that. So the law restrains evil. So the law is a mirror of God's righteousness and our sin. The law restrains sin, but there is what we call the third use of the law. And the third use of the law is that by obeying the law, it pleases God. And it's a sign of loving God. And so there's nothing old-fashioned in keeping the law. The third use of the law has kind of gone out of fashion a little bit these days in our contemporary evangelical church. But he's saying here, be very strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Okay. And so he's saying, look, he applies it in two very specific areas. We don't have time to develop this. Number one, in the area of association. You see that in verse 7? Do not associate with those nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. Now, famously, in the G.B. Phillips version, don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. How have we been affected by this? What does it say? Do not associate with those nations that remain among you. You know, there are things we watch on TV now that 10 years ago we would have blushed and switched off. Now, no problem. How we are merging into the world. We have no longer distinctive characteristics or holiness of life. It's an associate, a reference there to marriage, of course, as well. That in marriage, we've only to marry those who share our worldview, our Christian faith. That's how a marriage thrives. There's nothing more powerful than praying with someone. It is, I think, the most intimate act that you can ever do with someone, praying with them. And here is a clear opening to Christian marriage, association. A Christian worldview, that as believers we look at the world, we read a paper, we watch a movie through different eyes, through different perspectives. We are just different people, not kind of odd in a bizarre, kind of awkward sense, but just different. So the application is in association. The second application is in worship, verse 7 and 8. Don't associate with those nations. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them. Of course, we serve gods, don't we? The great god IKEA, the other great god Tesco, St. Michael's. All these gods of our ages, of our age, that we serve so unwittingly and yet with such devotion. An old city, you look at the city of London, the old city of London, and the horizon is dominated by steeples. These big, classic London churches with their crosses. You look at modern London, you see, you know, the Gherkin and Canary Wharf and all these other things. These are the temples of the new age. How many of us are worshipping these gods? You've heard the story of all of these things. And it says you've got to hold to the book of the law. Now, the thing about false gods is that they're not properly labeled. They're not labeled, these things will kill you. You know, I don't know if you're a smoker. If there's one group of folk I actually have a lot of sympathy for is smokers. You've been hounded to the edge of outer darkness as if you were the very worst human beings that ever lived. And you go out for a quick puff and your packet of cigarette tells you that you're going to, you know, die with these things. You know, I'm not encouraging the habit, but I do have some sympathy for you. But what's happening is that, well, there's a degree of honesty. It's a contract. The smoker has made a calculation that their pleasure actually, at the end of the day, is worth the risk of all these things. And they make that calculation. But the point is, there is a degree of honesty many things that our false gods offer us today are not labelled properly or honestly. They've been relabeled the necessities of life. I looked up, Googled the Bible, and where is the word Bible used? And I got these things. There was the Bible of barbecue. Could have bought it in Amazon. As much use as a chocolate teapot in Scotland. But the barbecue Bible, everything you know about barbecue. There was a track and the Bible of track and field. That's even less use to me. And there was the burger Bible. Bible to tell you everything you need to know about burgers. And maybe that's just an example of it's somewhat witty or a feeble attempt to be witty, but the gods of this age, the Bibles that we tend to read, not the Holy Law of Moses. The time is going, passing on the legacy, giving the credit, obeying the law, and fourthly, reaping the consequences. Reaping the consequences. Look at that. We see a carrot and we see a stick, don't we? See verse 9 for the carrot. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations to this day. No one is able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you, and just as he promises. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. From 9 to 11, we see grace. Loving the God who has given us everything. This great love affair with the God who loved us before we ever first loved him. But then there's a punishment, verse 12 and 13. That's very, very powerful. Especially 13. If you don't obey me, if you mingle with these nations, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Verse 16, if you violate the covenant of the Lord your God and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you and you will quickly perish from the good land the Lord has given you. These words are uncomfortable. The wrath of God, the punishment of God, the fact that God will actively destroy these people, his anger will burn against you. What sort of a God is that? Your neighbor will say. Well, I say one thing. These verses are uncomfortable, but are they unfair? Your neighbor says, what sort of a God is that who's angry when his law is disobeyed? Tell you what, you put your 5-year-old son out with a nail and tell him to write his name on the side of your neighbor's car. And he will soon say, that's not on. And then you take up a brick and smash his windows. That's not on. And then you rip out his roses. That's not on. A neighbor who just sat back and said, oh, aren't these children lovely? What lovely artwork on the side of my new car. You'd think such a person was ridiculous. That would be a beyond cartoon. And yet we expect God to behave like that. But it was at the Garden of Gethsemane then we finally, when we see the reason that if God, if folk want rid of a God of hell and wrath, they say, I want to believe in God because I want a more loving God. If you get rid of the idea of hell and wrath, you've got a less loving God. Because then it trivializes all that he has done. When I read these words, the Lord's anger will burn against you and you will quickly perish from the good land that he has given you. I see there, yes, the wrath of God, but I see the wrath of God poured out one Easter weekend on the Son of God on the cross of Calvary, taking the pain for us, so that we might have peace, so that we might have rest. These are not the rantings of an old post-100-year-old eccentric old man called Joshua. These are the writings of a man who prefigured Jesus, One who told of the love of God, one who told of the wrath of God. Folk, let's pass on the legacy. Let's give the credit to God. Let's obey God's law. And let's not reap the consequences. And let's thank God for Jesus. For without him, we would be, of all men, most miserable. Let's pray. Dear Lord, again we bless you for what you have done. We thank you for the power of the gospel. May we revel in it, rejoice in it. May we sing of your love forever. Forgive all our sins. Amen.